Welcome back to the Mel Kay Show. We got a big special show today with our pal Matt Arett that all of you know and love, and I'm very excited. Thank you for joining me, Matt.
Hey, it was a pleasure, Mel. Very happy to be with you.
Well, I'm very happy to be with you. One thing that people might not be fully aware of is that you've been producing incredible documentaries all along. And as people follow your Substack and they've bought your books and all of that, I don't know if they're fully aware of how in depth and how much knowledge you guys are putting into these amazing produced documentaries. And I wanted to talk about one that you have right now that I think everyone should go watch. So I think you want to play a little preview and then we'll talk about kind of a little in depth what we're seeing here.
Yeah, great. Thank you, Mel. And indeed, Cynthia and I have been really struggling with figuring out how do we provide a better, more refined analysis to people to better understand how they're being manipulated by these deeper waves of history, that once we're aware of them, we don't fall into the traps that would otherwise be set for us were we ignorant to how our ideology, the zeitgeist, right, the cultural matrix in which we were born has been influenced to bring about certain blind spots, emotional and intellectual, in our own character. This went on before we were even born. So that's the beauty of history, and especially approaching history from the standpoint of a battle of ideas and how ideas are generated within the minds of people, both towards the good or towards the bad, towards truth or towards evil and dishonesty. That is really the metaphysical domain that generates causally the nexus around which all wars, peace treaties, assassinations, revolutions, none of these things for thousands of years could be understood were it not for an appreciation for this battle of ideas. And the thing about ideas is that materialists are not comfortable treating a study of history or politics from this domain. Because ideas can't be weighed, they can't be seen, tasted, or touched, or smelled. It's an idea, it's a thought. But it has a causal effect in the material world. So there's this interesting reciprocation, right? That takes one very quickly into the occult. If you start in any honest analysis of what's shaping our world today, you can't avoid slapping head on into Freemasonic agencies, Rosicrucian, Kabbalistic, occult networks. And for one example, I don't have it with me, damn. But we have many figures who believe in creating a ritualistic form of purgative violence in the form of a great war that would be a cleansing war that would help out of the ashes to create a new type of human being. Some, you know, it has a different transhumanist taste to it, a flavor to it. Others we see are pushing a new religion that would replace the outdated Judeo-Christian systems that have animated us for thousands of years, and instead have a new type of religion that would be tied to what Klaus Schwab had dubbed a year and a half ago as the great narrative project to create new narrations, new sacred stories to shape us. So we, Cynthia and I, were hard at work thinking, how could we do a series that tackled that shed light onto this, while at the same time empowering people to avoid the type of this trap. And we took the form of the UFO myth, because we're like, okay, at the end of the day, there's a lot of heavy pressure across mainstream media, the CNN, the Pentagon, the Congress in Mexico and in the United States are carrying out highly publicized inquiries into government contact with UFOs. It's impossible to avoid. So we're like, well, what's really going on? So we did the first episode. It's now released. We released it about a week and a half ago, and we're going to show a little clip, a 10-minute clip from the first section of the video. And I'm hoping that people will watch the whole 30-minute video. It's going to be the first of a series of maybe 6 or 7 videos that'll go through this in much more detail. Cynthia took the lead in, designing the script for this first one, which goes back to the ancient world and will end at the emergence of theosophy, the spiritualist movement of the 19th century, that will set the stage for understanding where the UFO mythos came from. So this is what we're about to watch.
Is that Blavatsky and Alice Bailey? Okay.
Oh, yeah.
Very interesting to me. Let's watch it.
All right. So I'm going to start a couple of minutes in. I do a little short 3-minute intro to the audience. I'll do the last bit, and then we'll end it after the first section is done.
Great. Awesome.
World, shaped as it was by pagan mystery religions managed by priesthoods of initiates. We will do this in order to better appreciate how those occult mystery religions did not disappear with the rise of Christianity, as so many of us have been told, but merely went underground. This occult underground has continued throughout the centuries, operating in the shadows, orchestrating wars, coups, assassinations, and cultural warfare, leading up to the British Empire's Hellfire Club and the Society for Psychical Research of the 18th and 19th centuries. By establishing a direct connection between the ancient world and the modern era's imperial intrigues, tied to such things as Rosicrucianism, Kabbalism, Theosophy, and Freemasonic cults, it will become clear how the rebranding of ancient pagan priesthoods has unfolded into our modern times. Although it may not seem obvious at first, this exercise will be most important to understand how the UFO mythos emerged in the 20th century and the true purpose behind the revival of ancient pagan cults under a great reset today.
Why has shadowed human history since the first sharp realization of our own mortality? This question has never failed to spark a search for understanding, which in turn has left in its wake various myths, rites, and representations of the divine. According to the ancient writings of Hesiod in his Theogony, in the beginning there existed only chaos. Once arose Gaia and Eros. Then Gaia bore a being equal to herself, able to cover her entirely, starry Uranus. Gaia, with Uranus as her partner, would give birth to the 12 Titans, the first generation of Titans, 6 male and 6 female. Of these, Cronos partnered with his older sister Rhea, who then bore the first generation of Olympians, Zeus, Hades, Poseidon, Hestia, Demeter, and Hera. As the story is told by Hesiod, Uranus hated his children, the 12 Titans, and Gaia asked that her children rebel. Cronos is the only one to answer her call, and Uranus, drunken to penetrate the body of the earth, was castrated by Cronos with a sickle. From the blood that flowed upon Gaia, there came into the world the three Erinnyes, goddesses of vengeance, the giants, and the nymphs of ash trees. From the sexual organs of Uranus thrown into the sea, Aphrodite was born. This archaic myth represents the violent separation between heaven and earth. It is a myth that has been widely disseminated and documented in various cultures, including Egypt and India. In all likelihood, Hesiod knew these oriental traditions. His Theogony centered around the conflict between the divine generations and the struggle for universal sovereignty. Such origin myths, also known as creation myths, would serve as the foundation for the earliest cults. A cult, strictly speaking, is a particular system of religious worship, especially with reference to its rites and ceremonies. Etymologically, the word cult comes from the root of the word culture, representing the core system of beliefs and activities at the basis of a culture. Thus, every human being belongs to a cult in its most general sense, because everyone belongs to a culture. The literal and traditional meaning of the word cult is derived from the Latin cultus, meaning care or adoration. Apollo, also known as the god of the sun and of the light, was also god of archery, music, dance, truth and prophecy, healing and disease, poetry and more. The cult of Delphi was the most prominent and influential cult in ancient Greece and had its roots in the cult of Marduk, based in Babylon, and the cult of Horus, based in Egypt. In the cult of Delphi, a priestess, who it was said was intoxicated by the gas vapors of the chasm, would be the intermediary messenger who would deliver the words of the gods in indecipherable gibberish, to which the priests of Delphi would translate for those asking for prophecy. It is said that no large political decision was ever made in Greece, most notably in Athens and Sparta, without first consulting the oracle at Delphi. In Egypt, it was the pharaoh who acted as the obligatory intermediary between the gods and humans. The hierarchical priesthood overseeing the Egyptian cult of the pharaoh's pantheon of gods, as well as the rites of initiation, was at the heart of the growth of many of the secret societies across thousands of years. The Egyptian god equivalent to Apollo was Horus. Horus, the god of kingship, healing, protection, and the sun and sky, represented the kingship itself and was seen as a protector of the pharaoh. In Babylon, the Apollo equivalent is Marduk, whose name means calf of the sun, and thus is the son of the sun. Like the cult of Apollo at Delphi and the cult of Horus in Egypt, no king of Babylon would decide on making war or peace without first consulting the oracle of the Marduk priesthood. It is thought that the temples of Apollo, Horus, and Marduk were linked under a common network and thus controlled all intelligence and decisions for war and peace between these nodes. The priests effectively operated above all else, with no specific loyalty towards the kings they were advising and the welfare of their people. These mystery cults or mystery religions would continue to play a central role within Rome, Byzantium, and later empires, and continue in their influences to this day. The mystery cults take the form of three main branches: the Mithraic, the Orphic Apollonian, and the Dionysian mysteries. Thus, the mystery cults, which reserved their secret knowledge for initiates who would seek wisdom and power through esoteric practices and rituals, generally interpreted their scriptures allegorically to reveal so-called hidden spiritual truths that were usually known only to the higher-ranking initiates of the religion. This is what has made up the hidden hand behind the political decisions and spiritual beliefs of the day for millennia.
That is good stuff. I'll tell you what, production wise, you guys projects you put together are incredible. Now this is that looked a lot like Epstein Island to me. I don't know.
Yeah, there's probably a connection.
Well, that temple on Epstein Island is the real deal. And a lot of this stuff, you know, we can see a lot of this stuff from the sky, that the Eye of Horus, you know, a lot of this stuff is out there, and it's out there big time in Hollywood, in music, in photography, in art. So like she, you're saying in the project, this is not stopped. This occult esoteric worship. So let's talk a little bit about what made you guys decide to do this, this project now. How does it inform where we are?
Well, I had already tried to take a stab at the alien mythos and the cult of alien, or a new set of cults that would be associated with aliens that took the form of a long article that I did in 2019 called What Does Lawrence Rockefeller, MK Ultra, and UFOs Have in Common More Than You Think?
Yeah. I remember that. Oh, yeah. Okay. Right.
And so I started scratching at it there, and I took a more geopolitical tone. I didn't bring in parapsychology or the occult. I didn't do that because that's not where my mind was at the time. I simply was focusing on the geopolitical aspect of Lawrence Rockefeller and the Rockefeller brothers as a whole, as playing a key role in shaping or misshaping the 20th century and cultivating the deep state over the dead body of people like JFK and Martin Luther King and many others. But Lawrence Rockefeller's role specifically as a patron of the Esalen Institute, of Terence McKenna and his international work exploring psilocybines and the spiritual consequence of McKenna's theories as well regarding interfacing with beings from other dimensions. I only brought that in summarily and how that interfaces with the CIA MKUltra program that normalized a lot of the different types of psychedelic drugs into the baby boomer generation. I touched on it, but only indirectly, because Lawrence Rockefeller, though people may not be aware, is the founder of the Disclosure Project and was the person who hired Stephen Greer, for example, who was a regular on his estate, who was part of the human potential movement of the Esalen Institute, which is itself part of the Stanford Research Institute's work on parapsychology and other things in the 70s, overseen by people like Jacques Vallée and like Alan Hynek and Hal Puthoff, who are often dancing with the occult themselves. Vallée is somebody who's notoriously a friend with Anton LaVey, other Satanists, as is Hal Puthoff, who's a seventh degree operating thetan from the Scientology Church. And there are many Scientologists who are very high level involved with the Stanford Research Institute. So all of this was being bankrolled by Lawrence Rockefeller, which you're like, well, how would this mesh? Are this idea of having a drug liberation and the right to know about UFOs and government disclosure and Roswell, which is one of Lawrence Rockefeller's big passions, was getting the truth on Roswell to be made well known and get Bill Clinton to release the documents. Why does a creature like that care about our right to know the truth and have access to drug liberation for a new spirituality? Doesn't that seem like two different things regarding his work as an imperialist pushing for global depopulation and world government? No, it's actually two sides of the exact same thing. And that's part of why we decided to make this film series. But again, Cynthia became so useful because it wasn't working. We tried doing the first draft of this film in February, and we were working with Jason Dahl, our filmmaker, who he tried to take my script, and it wasn't catching, it wasn't biting properly. And we did another redraft of the script, much longer, and this time it still wasn't capturing. I added a little bit of coloring about Ellen Dulles and a lot of JFK's enemies at the CIA, who played also a role in organizing Area 51, utilizing UFO technology flying saucer technology that had been developed by the Germans and the Italian aerospace engineers, absorbed by the U.S. military industrial complex. And a lot of the key people like Richard Bissell and Charles Cabell were overseeing Project Blue Book, Area 51, testing out new drone tech. And these are all the figures who JFK was purging from the CIA and who killed him and took back control over his dead body, who were all behind also UFO, the UFO PSYOP. So it still wasn't working. And then Cynthia said, the problem is you're missing the purpose of all of this. And I was like, what's the purpose? And she's like, it's to create a new religion. And I'm like, of course. So she took she basically said, okay, let me try to write the first episode. And she did that first episode with her research on the occult and deep history, and said, okay, this is what's setting the tempo for everything else. Cause that's really what they want, is to create a new religion centered around redefining what was Jesus, what was Moses, what were the pharaohs doing around the pyramids? What was Muhammad? What was all of the ancient stories of different civilizations? And then they want to recast everything around the idea that it was drug initiates from the Eleusinian mysteries, like, you know, who were able to tap into other dimensions using the power of psychedelics like wheat blight or opium, that gave them access to these entities from other dimensions, which they call demons or angels or elves or whatever, where Jesus was probably that, they say. And then we could keep Christianity, we can keep Islam, we can keep these Abrahamic religions, but they'll be redefined around a new idea that will extract the divine out of the picture. It'll extract the idea of us being made in the image of God, because now we're just made in the image of aliens who just created us in a UFO laboratory with monkey DNA, whatever. And it's embedded. This is a longstanding agenda, which was put into motion by creative writers and predictive programmers like H.G. Wells, who played a big role in this with his War of the Worlds and a lot more. And this has been sort of the idea, and it's been interfacing. We're going to be bringing in different Jesuitical operations as well that interface with this, certain Mormon operations, which interface with this. But yeah, that's really the thing. So that made this, that changed, this first episode changed completely how we're thinking now about every single subsequent episode, which will deal more with the 20th century.
Yeah, I think that's really important. That's that all of these groups are fascinating on their own and together. And I first had Cynthia on almost 3 years ago when she really dug into Huxley and what they were doing in California, a lot of that, and the early years of Anton LaVey and Aleister Crowley. And we have to really understand that none of this went away. And it's in our faces constantly, especially in symbolism that we see everywhere. And you have to question, you know, it's never gone away. But what you're saying right now, people have to know that you and I talked about this, I think, when it happened. There was a event, Mount Sinai, the same globalist billionaire oligarchy I talk about all the time, had an event about religion where they talked about a one world religion, redefining religion. It was at a COP conference. And they all gathered there to talk about some kind of inner workings of Christianity, Catholicism, Islam, and Judaism all coming together. And around that same time, there were Noah Harari from the World Economic Forum, the prophet of the World Economic Forum, was out there saying, you know, there is no free will, you know, that they're going to replace religion with a benevolent AI. And basically that everything that people think about religion is a fraud, and that they're going to redefine it and have people understand that it's not real. Again, this has to be related to that. So talk a little bit about that whole storyline that's come out of that world, because I would think that it has something to do with world communism, because, of course, in communism, you can't have God as it is. I don't know.
Well, this thing precedes, as we know, communism emerged in the mid-19th century. This precedes this by thousands of years. Right. And what you're dealing with is an idea of restoring a dark age by design. The intention is to have a dark age, because the idea is that dark age periods are periods whereby the control migrates from people to a master class above the people that can erase troublesome ideas, troublesome memories of the collective people, our collective memories of our past, what allowed the American Revolution to happen, what was Christianity. All of these things during dark ages, we forget. We forget technologies we used to know. We forget how to do things we used to do. And we become more superstitious. That's actually something a Rand report in 1950 overseen by Frank Stanton, who was himself overseeing the War of the Worlds broadcast in New York in 1938. Frank Stanton was one of the two guys. Henry Cantrell was the other one. Both very closely tied to Lawrence and Nelson Rockefeller. Both funded, that was actually funded by the Rockefeller Brothers Fund, was the social experiment to see how people would react to the rendering of H.G. Wells' tale of a Martian invasion, killing soldiers and police and civilians. How would people react psychologically, right? So Stanton goes on to become one of the key founders of this new synergy between the military-industrial complex, psychiatrists, and the CIA in the form of Rand. And they write a report on superstitions in 1950. That identifies the importance of psychological warfare and cultivating superstitions in different target audiences that have to be profiled, which they were already doing, but they wanted to centralize this a lot more. And they go into depth. We're going to cite this in our third episode of the series.
Right.
And they make the point that people are more susceptible to superstitions when they are in crisis. So when there's a shock therapy, when there's a shock to your system, you become much more malleable. Your critical thinking disappears. You are accepting of new stories that give you a sense of order because the mind craves order and reason, right? That's why the mind exists. The senses are constantly an influx of infinite impressions that don't, that are kind of chaotic. So the mind exists to find simple order and purpose behind the effects of the senses. They work together, right, and they're supposed to dance together. They want to deconstruct that. And that superstition report by Rand informed also how the messaging for what people were seeing when they were looking out of their window, starting in 1947, 48, and seeing experimental aircraft, usually over military bases, and they didn't know what to make of it, or pilots without security clearance were looking out of their windows and seeing experimental aircraft flying around, would report it back to their commanding officer. And they're not allowed to know what is going on in Area 51 or any of these other bases. So they needed to message a story to frame the narrative.
Hey guys, thank you for watching the show. I just want to remind you yet again that we really need to be very cautious of what is going on with the economy, both here and internationally. Most of us know that the BRICS nations are looking for a gold-backed currency to dethrone the dollar being the world reserve currency. They have an event coming up on August 22nd. The BRICS nations are all going. There are also 13 other nations that would like to join the BRICS nations, and this is not something to not pay attention to. We have to make sure that you protect your savings. And that is why I have chosen Beverly Hills Precious Metals. That is where I have gotten my gold and silver. I leave it in a depository. I know it's there. I've replaced it with my savings. I've put there to make sure that I weather the storm no matter what, be it the central bank digital currency, the BRICS nations, the dollar goes into collapse, whatever may happen. I know 401k, IRA, backed by gold, as well as having my savings, at least an amount of my savings in gold in the depository or sent to you at home, is the best way to make sure you maintain peace of mind and make sure that your savings and everything that you've earned is safe no matter what comes. We will get through this. All is not lost. America will return to greatness as it always has been. But between now and then, we have to be very smart and very cognizant of what's going on. So please go to Mel K Gold, or go to the MelKShow.com partners page and go to Beverly Hills Precious Metals, and my friend Andrew will take care of you. He's got a great team. Gold is the way to go right now, and I know that no matter what, I'm safe. So please do that for yourselves. We really care about you here. You're more like family and friends, and I hear from all of you a lot. So I just want to make sure that you guys are doing something proactive to be prepared. All will be well, but take care of yourself now. Being prepared is always a good thing.
That was informed by the idea, well, we can use this by giving people a sense that there are these extraterrestrial beings, and we'll play with that. We'll also, and the CIA was also funding a lot of art and literature, a lot of the books by people like L. Ron Hubbard, who was a devotee of Aleister Crowley. You know, he made his career first as a sci-fi writer. He wasn't alone. He had people like George Adamski, also writing sci-fi, you know, fiction around aliens interfacing, but that not only entertained, it wasn't designed to simply entertain the masses, as we are told. It was designed to psychologically produce predictive programming on the one hand, to prepare the mind of the zeitgeist around future magic tricks that would be planned for us that we wouldn't think critically about when they do happen. And the other thing was to also provide sort of a guiding light to creating new spiritual control mechanisms. Like Scientology was, I think, an early experiment to create a synthetic controlled religious order that was never designed to be forever, but it was designed to be a test, kind of like what Manson was coming out of MKUltra. Scientology was a little bit higher because, L. Ron Hubbard was so close to Crowley, and this gets us closer to the higher up British intelligence operatives.
When I was little, they had commercials constantly for Dianetics. Nobody knew what Scientology, I mean, in my world, nobody knew what Scientology was. Really? But that was, I remember there were commercials constantly when we were, you know, when you still had a box for cable and you had to push the box. It was like, they were really, really pushing that. And that was early on. And it was a huge campaign. I mean, huge. No, so it couldn't have just been the Church of Scientology that was implementing that into everyone's households. It had to have been bigger than that.
Yeah, well, Dianetics was very much informed by cybernetics. Cybernetics analysis being the science of controls that emerged by, you know, through the work of Norbert Wiener, a disciple of Bertrand Russell, who often worked very closely with H.G. Wells. But Norbert Wiener was one of Russell's devotees at Cambridge, who was assigned the task of creating a practical aspect to the scientific theories of the Principia Mathematica that Bertrand Russell had published with Alfred North Whitehead in 1910, 12, 13, these three volumes that tried to mathematize the universe. And the idea of Russell as a high-level grand strategist was that we needed to find a way to get everybody's minds, especially focusing on the scientific community, because you needed to control science. Science is a very disruptive thing for empire. It's a troublesome thing because it's the domain where discoveries tend to happen. Now, where discoveries tend to happen is where those who monopolized pre-existing knowledge sets and resources and modalities of production, consumption, transportation, all of those things, they tend to lose their influence because a new discovery is of something that is not yet monopolized. Right?
I mean, like settled science that we've all the settled science, trust the science. The science is settled.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. That's insane. That should never happen. So that's what they've created as the standard model. You want to be respected. You want to be published. You want to keep a job. Abide by the standard model. You'll have freedom to the degree that you stay within this cage, and you will have freedom to move in the cage. But real scientists don't like cages. They like discoveries. So that was part of what Bertrand Russell was trying to do with the Principia, was to say, okay, let us do what Newton tried and failed to do, which is to mathematize the universe and try to get people to assume that if they want to be scientists, they have to think of the universe as being purely expressible or all phenomena known and unknown can be reduced to a limited set of core assumptions bounded by symbolic logic. So by having maybe, 30, 40 limited assumptions, you could then, and it's limited your assumptions, you could then take everything that has ever been and ever will be and reduce everything to a mechanism, kind of like Laplace's daemon. Same idea as Laplace's daemon earlier. So this is what was done in theory, despite the fact that it was proven to be impossible by Kurt Gödel, Einstein's collaborator.
And what years is this? Is this around when the technocratic movement was happening in the 30s and they were trying to make everything about that?
This is a little bit before that. Russell was writing this in 1913 when he was still working with the Fabians. He always was, as was Wells. They had different functions to play. Yeah. But the technocratic movement came about a lot later, but they were a lower level control mechanism that was supposed to be sold as one of the great solutions to the Great Depression that had been orchestrated, kind of like today's. To say, if we just allowed scientists to manage us instead of these elected officials, we wouldn't have these problems and no nation states. So Russell had a devotee. And so Norbert Wiener was working in the Manhattan Project in the Air Force and radar, especially, that allowed him. He figured out with his work on radar and working with certain British scientists around Sir Henry Tizard, who is a very high-level controller and actually orchestrator of the Manhattan Project itself. He's actually, people don't know this, it was a British guy, Sir Henry Tizard, who came in 1940 to help formulate the construction of how the new compartmentalized science, secret science, would be set up in America. And he's the one who made sure that J. Robert Oppenheimer, a theosophist-oriented mystic occultist who's probably a sociopath, would be in a controlling position. He made sure to ice out certain moral scientists like Einstein and Kurt Gödel. Kurt Gödel being Einstein's friend, who proved in 1932 that Bertrand Russell's thesis was entirely a fiction and a fraud, by proving that through his incompleteness theorem, that there would always be within every system that you try to describe something that is self-referential that demands an external process outside of any self-referencing system that is not contained within that limited system, which is closed. So Gödel destroyed Russell's thesis, but despite that, Russell's devotees continued with the project, which they finally came up with, which emerged with Norbert Wiener's work on feedback loops regarding, radar and how you need to get metrics of position and velocity of planes or rockets coming at you and calculate in your air defense system where the rocket or plane would be. So you have to process that information, plug it into your machine guns or whatever, so that they shoot on the targets where it will be in the future. And that had certain useful applications in warfare. But what was then recognized by the Macy, Josiah Macy Foundation, which sponsored the Macy Foundations on cybernetics, was that this could be applied to everything. This is what Bertrand Russell had dreamed of. And that's where RAND Corporation became the first cybernetics organized system of scientific managed policymaking in America that would eliminate the human element by having just computers program and process information, right? And the science of control was that, okay, we could just take anything, the OECD, NATO, a government institution, whatever, and bureaucratize it so that everybody in each department and sub-department only is hyper-specialized to know what they're assigned to do and not know what the left hand is doing if you're a right hand, such that only the people in a nervous system, so they use the model of a central nervous system, only the people in the know who are the elect, the initiates, are granted the right to see what the whole machinery is doing. And that allows for a type of conspiracy theory or the type of conspiracy, an actual conspiracy to function, because most people don't understand that they're a part of it. Because they're right.
That's interesting because we've heard from people in the DOD and Pentagon and also in Big Pharma that's the tactic. What you're talking about right now is how they do a lot of things that are nefarious or that we would not be wanting our money to go towards is they segregate everyone. People don't know that they're working on one part of something much bigger, and then they put them into academia in different institutions. They then put the money in, you know, we've seen Gates's money, but our government does it, funds projects where these people are siloed. They think that they're working on one thing, but really, like you're talking about, the nerve center at the top knows that that's just one part of this and that and this. And each one of those scientists, and a lot of scientists have died because of this, as far as I can see, murdered or it's mysterious deaths when they start to realize that whatever they're working on is part of something else. And that something else is very dangerous and they don't want to be a part of it. And, you know, either their patent gets stolen, they disappear, they have a weird car accident. I think it's Steve Quayle who has like a list of all these scientists over like decades that have had these mysterious deaths.
You know what they do, right? So there's two aspects of this because people say, there's two aspects. You have people like Jacques Vallée, who is not only a cyberneticist and a big steer of the UFO mythos, especially from the 70s, right? He was part of Alan Hynek's Invisible College, sort of a modern Rosicrucian Invisible College of parapsychologists and occultists who were employed by Esalen and then later at the Stanford Research Institute, which is sort of the control nexus for a lot of this stuff, where they tried to give a scientific veneer using quantum mechanical language to, seances, reading of ghosts, telepathy, things like that. And that would also involve ufology as well, was spliced in to make it like a new smorgasbord, but with a new scientific veneer, taking it out of the fringe and into scientific respectability. So what these creatures were doing, number one, Vallée was a cyberneticist. He was a co-founder of ARPANET, the first generation internet. That's what he was doing. He was working with Hal Putoff as well. Both Hal Putoff, the Scientologist guy I told you about, and Vallée were both venture capitalists as well, who sponsor, that's what they're known for their public money-making schemes, is they sponsor great innovative ideas that will then become brought in from the secret, you know, the secret research bureaus of the military-industrial complex into the civilian sector. Lawrence Rockefeller was the world's first scientific venture capitalist when he created his fund, the Rockefeller Brothers Fund, in 1946. And it had a subsidiary whose name I'm forgetting to do just this very thing. So we act like, it's the power of just great capitalism that just produces all these great ideas. And it's like, no, kind of in yes and no. But a lot of these ideas are being stolen by great scientists who think that, I'm getting some money from the Navy. I'm getting some money from Lockheed Martin to fund my prototypes and my ideas. Great. All I've got to do is sign this thing. Now, all of a sudden, it starts producing results, like the Robert Boussard Polywell fusion devices or cold fusion. There's a whole variety of things. It's producing results. It's breaking the laws of physics. And all of a sudden, you sign the contract.
Gotta it stop. Disappears. Right.
Now all of a sudden, yeah, exactly. It's absorbed. You're iced out. It's absorbed into the shadow realm. Right. And something comes out, you're either killed or you're iced out, whatever the case may be, you can't play a role in the thing anymore. And now all of a sudden, Hal Putoff comes out with like To the Stars Academy of Arts and Sciences, a front organization that works with, who's the Pizzagate guy?
You're talking about John Podesta?
Yeah, Podesta.
So yeah, Podesta, he's a big UFO guy. Him and Harry Reid, they were big into the UFOs, and you had to know if they were talking about it, it wasn't about the UFOs.
Exactly. And so Podesta is working with To the Stars Academy, set up by Hal Puthoff. You have Harry Reid, who's being bankrolled by Robert Bigelow, a billionaire real estate magnate who put the money into the first headquarters of the National Institute for Discovery Science in 1993. That was overseen by Puthoff and Vallée and a variety of other occultists, which was all designed to be a place where they would say, look, we funded this great new discovery in quantum mechanics or biotech or energy science, and now we're going to bring it to the market. Now, they're making a ton of money, and it's a control mechanism for releasing acceptable spectrums of discovery into the civilian sector while withholding others that you don't want released in a very tightly controlled way.
Does CERN fit into this at all, or is CERN its own little thing? Because CERN is all occult and scary.
Well, okay, that's a big topic, but
we
CERN
can do it at different time. Yeah.
But I'll say a word on that. Yes, and it has two big purposes. Number one is to absorb a lot of the money and energy that would otherwise be going into actually making discoveries into atomic science and put it into a place that's run by a bunch of occult controlled mathematicians who are themselves. Cause that's the thing. If you want to make a mystic, create a reductionist materialist. So
they don't hide their crazy occult ceremonies there. Like they know that they're being watched when they put on their hoods and walk outside and walk in circles, and they know that people are watching them, you know?
Yes.
So CERN wants you to know that they're doing something bizarre, it's not normal.
Yeah, no, it's like a bit of a sick joke. Like they're using a type of alchemical language, which they know has worked throughout history, where you could say certain things right in front of somebody's face and they won't be able to see it because the mind doesn't work in this way naturally. It has to be groomed to move in this crazy ass symbolic way that's tied to crazy thinking. So it's sort of like a way to create a magic spell. And that's why, like I was just about to say, one thing really interesting about the human mind is that if you want to make a superstitious occultist, make a reductionist materialist. So if somebody thinks that to use their logic means only using sense perception and rules of computer logic, which is fine from a computer, like pattern association thinking, you know, that's a fine, useful thing. We program it into computers. You know, this set of dots on my face, that relationship of dots that are charted in a mathematical, space, whenever a similar face with these similar relationships occurs, that is associated with this identity of Matthew, says the computer. Okay, human minds can do that, but if we limit ourselves to just doing that, we will cut off what we actually are. The computer, this part of the creation of this, what Yuval Harari is talking about with this new AI cult that will replace human thought and human beings, rendering us irrelevant unless we merge with machines and stay relevant a little bit longer, but we're ultimately going to go. So if you think that you just have mathematics the way Bertrand Russell or Newton says that you just have to make observations and render description of observations based on deductive and inductive lines of logic, if that's all you think you have as a mind to navigate through the universe, you will soon hit a wall because the universe is not that linear. The universe has a transcendental component. There is things that those mechanisms will never allow you to touch. So when you deal with then the golden section, which requires, look at the Greeks. They're building all of their geometries of buildings around the golden section. It's a very important part of nature. The growth of flowers, of our own life, of it's all over living organisms, is this purport, the divine proportion, right? If as soon as you try to apply radical mathematical logic to that, it fails because it's based upon dealing with something that is outside of the realm of pure deductive logic. So how do you account for its existence? It exists. Well, then you become a mystic. Then you're like, well, you see, And and this is where Albert Pike read his Morals and Dogma, and they will mystify the golden section, the Pythagorean theorem, all of these things. And then all of a sudden you're on the path to hell. And a lot of the mathematicians that came in with Niels Bohr and Oppenheimer, who disagreed with the old guard of scientists who were moral discoverers of reality, like Madame Curie and Mendeleev and Einstein and Max Planck, they were the old guard who were deemed obsolete because they were using a way of thinking that said, no, mathematics is useful, but it has to serve a role within a higher realm of thinking that ties into music. They were all artists. They understood you had to cultivate your aesthetic sensibilities of beauty, which is why Max Planck and Einstein would play music. They would play Mozart together when they had a mathematical challenge they couldn't solve. And then they would return to their problem with a new creative esprit that would give them insights to solve problems, which gave birth to the quantum realm in the first place. Now, the new generation around Heisenberg and Bohr and Wolfgang Pauli were all being bankrolled by the Rockefeller Foundation because they liked that approach of the Copenhagen School, saying that said, no, there is, we reject the assumption that there is causality. That was the starting point of Niels Bohr, that there is no truth in good science. Science only uses mathematical probability theory. So we know where maybe an electron might be, and it became the science of maybes. And it has a practical usefulness on a limited technical level to use the science of maybes, but you will always be stuck within the standard model. You will never discover something principally true beyond what is already known in that sense. So this is the next generation of scientists who were all occultists. Niels Bohr, all of these guys were all into the occult. And they were brought into,
How about Kurzweil and singularity and all of that? Does that fit into this too? Yes. Because that stuff's really insane as well. And again, this is a venture capitalist putting in billions of dollars. Epstein was a big funder of a lot of this stuff, as many other ones were. Kurzweil's been out there for about 20 years talking transhumanism and never got attention really from the mainstream. Now all these people do because of Harari and all that, but Kurzweil's been talking about singularity and that we have to just accept the future that he's talking about. How does that fit in?
Yeah, same thing. So the transhumanist movement emerged out of the cybernetics movement. So part of one of the consequences of the cybernetics cosmology is that the entire universe, everything can be seen as systems, right? A system is that which has parts which work together within a whole for a purpose. Now, that's a fact. Everything is systems, right? Every cell in my body is a system. My body is a system. Every organ is a system. The humanity is one system, right? And nature is a system that exists within a solar system, that exists within a galactic system. They're all units with parts that move together for a purpose, shaped by the whole. That's more than the sum of the parts. Now, here's where the cyberneticist creates a schism, where they say for the low-level cyberneticists, who will be the monkey, like the technicians, not part of the initiated class, they will presume that the system is the sum of its parts. That has certain mechanisms, Darwinian mechanisms. They will believe in just a mechanical universe. The higher initiates will be brought into a more spiritual state to recognize, no, the whole is more than the sum of the parts. But those initiates will then be brought into crazy land because that whole is animated ultimately by forces that are deemed to be ultimately satanic or evil.
That have an end goal. They know what they want the outcome to be, the people that are the puppet masters, but all these other guys, you know, they're just moving right along thinking they're inventing things that they know the outcome that they want, it seems.
Yeah, they're the people who read, you know, Scientific American, act like they're all know-it-alls, they're engineers, but they're just deconstructed and they don't know how to use their mind properly, and they're useful for what they do within a machine, but they're not meant to know what the machine is. Yeah.
Yeah, and a lot of them are captured by academia and by grants and all this. That's why discovery only happens, you know, when powers that be want it to. And that's very interesting. You bring up the hedge fund and the capital venture capitalists, and then, you know, InQtel and DARPA and all of this, it's all over there. And we could go on for 3 days. But I want to make sure that we get to something before we end, because how does this all, and this is probably a longer conversation, Matt will be back next week. And we want you to go watch his, the first of the series, because you're going to be blown away and be hooked right away. But the last thing I wanted to say, because we're bringing all this up, the odd advent of out of nowhere, faux pope comes out and bans Freemasonry. And I'm thinking, what is this? And then, you know, then you see all the videos come up online about the occult Freemasons and what happened, 33rd degree. And I'm seeing it everywhere. He just did that this week. Why would he do that this week?
Freemasonry is not the end all be all of the occult. I mean, that's not like the thing that's making everything happen. It's one of many things.
Right.
That is making.
But it looks like the Pope is like pointing at it for some reason right now. Is it a distraction? That's what I thought.
I think that it's a couple of things. It's sort of the same reason why they promoted, because I didn't even get to the question of like the new green religion around a restoration of stasis and Gaia. But yeah, I think what you're seeing right now is the setting of the stage. We're being played like a violin in some ways, in the same way that people back in 1890s were being played around the Protocols of Zion. Which was a forged set of documents that were promoted by occultists in the Okhrana, the Russian secret police tied to the Holy Brotherhood, which are these old feudalist families that wanted to restore feudalism. They wanted to re-enslave the serfs of Russia. And they always interfaced closely with their French and English and other Italian Freemasonic occult brethren. A lot of the same families, right, are all intermingling, as always the case. But part of the protocols as well, they're talking about revealing, and they publicize it. You know, Henry Ford is pouring cash into publicizing it. Aleister Crowley, Churchill is writing documents reviewing the Protocols of Zion, all exposing the Jewish Freemasonic conspiracy to enslave the world using Jewish bankers, and they name a bunch of these. And it's like there's elements of truth to what's being exposed, but what's not being exposed, and why is this so useful at cultivating a new variation of conservatism that manifests itself in the form of the SS. Hitler was a great believer in the Protocols of Zion as a factual document, and so the right wing movements of the world become so disgusted by the corruption of Bolshevism. Especially under George Lukács, the reforms in education, bringing in sex ed into Hungary, and the threat that this might spill over internationally, that you create, this is the old left-right dichotomization, you create a reactionary right that then needs a scapegoat to then, and the Jews became a very useful thing, Freemasonic groups became a useful thing, and there's good and bad Freemasonic lodges, today it's mostly bad, but regardless, that became an organizing principle in the same way that today the Jews, yet again, as well as China, are the chosen organizing principles of hate and fear that has been sold to the West to prepare us for a new war with what basically China primarily is what Jake Sullivan said we have to.
It's totally manipulative and crazy. And all of this makes so much sense when you look at it all. But this is the thing I love about you. There's no new playbooks. There's nothing is new. The thing that you do the best and why I love having you on is whether we're talking about what we're talking about now, which folks, we are going to have a part two. We have to go. We're coming back. We're going to talk about this more in depth. But what Matt's talking about now, the reason I brought up the Pope and Freemasonry this week is because they don't come up with new playbooks. So the minute that they start to enter something else, you have to think, well, what have they done in the past to manipulate society that worked, because they're going to try it again. And if we see it up close, like Matt and Cynthia are putting this whole project together so that you see it's been done, you will see it again. But I have a feeling a lot of the stuff that you guys are exposing in this is happening now, just in ways that we don't really see right away because it's modernized. But it still sounds like the same manipulation, the same methods, the same, you know, kind of like, well, we know, and you should be scared, but you're not sure of what. So, you know, I just think it's fascinating that your series is coming out at this time when we're seeing them pull out all the stops yet again.
Yep. Thank you, Mel.
It's true. Matt Arett, where can people see it? We're putting the link below. Matt will be back in a few days to do a part two of this. And we will also have on his wife to talk in depth about a little bit more of the stuff that she focuses on as well upcoming. So, Matt, where can they see this? Go there right now and watch it. Fascinating stuff.
Yeah, help us spread it. We don't have any official platform beyond our main websites to spread it.
So everywhere.
Thank you, guys. Everybody out there watching it, people can go to risingtidefoundation.net or more easily. You'll probably have an easier time finding this video on canadianpatriot.org. So watch it, rewatch it, take notes, share it with your network, and give us feedback. If you have any thoughts as well or questions or feedback you'd like to have answered, send us an email at info@risingtidefoundation.net.
Great. And we'll share it on our website and we'll put it out there as well everywhere we are. And I'm looking forward to all of them. And thank you, Matt Arett, for always. But every time you to go into something that seems so out there, then I realize, oh, my God, they're going to try this again and they're just going to modernize it. It's amazing work you do. And I will see you next week. We will all see you next week. Thank you so much, Matt. Fascinating. Appreciate it. Bye-bye. Cheers. Oh, I hope you're enjoying the show. I was just talking on my new Patriot Mobile service. I have to tell you, I'm so excited. They are incredible. They are America first. They align with my values. And you know what? It's unlimited minutes, unlimited text, Wi-Fi calling, unlimited data, high speed, everything that you could use, just like everyone else. We have our time, we have our vote, and we have our money. And the great thing about Patriot Mobile is your service will be exactly the same. Difference with Patriot Mobile is they are an America first company. And what they do is they reinvest their money into causes that matter to me and matter to you and matter to this nation. At Patriot Mobile, those causes are the First Amendment, the Second Amendment, life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness, the Constitution, and our children's future. So please go to themelkshow.com. Patriot Mobile is a partner of ours. Please use the code MELK. What I can tell you too is that they are supporting me and they are supporting creators because they believe in the First Amendment. They believe that censorship is wrong and they are going to put their money where their mouth is. Do what you can for the creators out there that are doing what I'm doing. Please go to Patriot Mobile, MELK Show. All I can say is thank you so much, guys. Supporting my partners supports me, and Patriot Mobile is absolutely awesome. I checked them out. We're switching to Patriot Mobile and we hope you do too. Thank you so much. Hi, guys. You know, for months and months, me and Mike Al have been talking about the water supply, what is in there. There are pharmaceuticals in the water supply. There are all these chemicals, lots of pollution. We've had all these natural disasters that leave our water not nearly as clean and certainly not as God intended. We know how important water is for our health. So we have been on a mission to try to find the best alternative to the water that is out there, including bottled water, which, of course, we did a whole show on everything that's in bottled water, which is almost as shocking as what's in our natural water now. So we found the best partner we could in Healthy Hydrogen. This is a portable bottle that I use all the time, but also there are many options over there. You can get a full house system. You can get a tabletop system. You can get for your shower, for your office and business. They have so many great options. If you go to themelkshow.com, we have partnered with them. So it's on our partners page, Healthy Hydrogen. I am telling you right now, the difference in this water and what it will do to your health in general is incredible. If you have inflammation, your immune system has problems, anything that you are thinking you don't know the solution for, this could be the game changer. We've been looking for the missing piece, and I believe the missing piece is the water. We are so excited. They have so much science backing all of their products. They have been tested by all different groups out there that do this for a living and look at water really in depth. We have the hydrogen aspect, which is truly fascinating. Nothing is more important than water. We all know that. So make sure you're putting the best water in your body. And I assure you, this is a true, true game changer that you will see right away and will improve your health and your family's health going forward. Go check out the MELK Show partners page, Healthy Hydrogen, and get your health back from the inside out, starting with God's great water. We will see you soon. Thank you so much. Enjoy the rest of the show.